were poisoned in England, even though he didn't die, they made this a huge issue. And the whole of the EU, the United States, Canada, felt 153 Russian diplomats. Result. In the case of Iran, there's no condemnation. And in addition to that, there is no force behind the statements themselves. So Iran is forced to take the initiative. Iran will definitely retaliate. But also Iran will reduce its commitments to the nuclear deal as well as cooperate with the JCPOA. It retaliates against the regime for the attack. And Iran's reduced commitment to cooperation will be a response to U.S. attack and the difference.
Dr. Mirindi, three U.S. officials have said that Israel was behind the assassination of Iranian scientist Martin Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, according to a report by the New York Times just hours after the assassination. We never had a doubt, to be honest, that the U.S. and Israel are the closest of allies and that have been sharing for a long time now intelligence regarding Iran in specific. However, this act of terrorism stirs a lot of concern about the infiltration of the Israeli Mossad inside of the Islamic Republic of Iran. How is this concern being dealt with within the Iranian government?
Well, this was not an Israeli operation. The Americans led the operation. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who gave the green light. They gave the logistical support through neighboring countries. Just like they did under the Obama regime, mm-hmm. where they killed or murdered four Iranian scientists on different occasions. The United States was the real force back then. So back then, with Obama, who was helping the Israelis murder Iranians, and now it's Trump doing the same. So the Israelis on their own do not have the ability, and that's why Iran's response must be robust, both in punishing the Israeli regime, mm-hmm. but also punishing the Americans as well, in order to create a deterrent for prevent future acts of terrorism. And Iran's response to the United States will be ending its current, the carrying out of current obligations within their deal. Remember, the Europeans and Americans are not abiding by any of their but the Iranians are still abiding by some of their commitments. That will probably come to an end. And the International Atomic Energy Agency oversight will decrease significantly. So in this way, Americans will see that terrorist attack will have negative consequences. And the Israeli regime will see that terrorist attack will have negative consequences. But it is difficult for Iran, obviously, to fight against the constant attempts to undermine the country's sovereignty by opposition of the country alongside the Israeli regime and big leaderships in our region that support this idea and also the terrorism.
Well, Dr. Mirindi, less than 24 hours after the incident, we have people from all walks of life gathering outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S. Assassinating the top Iranian general commander Qasem Soleimani in January 2020. What do you think are the options for Iran in resolving this issue, which quickly became a public opinion issue?
Well, this was an act of war, and that's why people were so angry. And Iranian government senior military officials, whether General Soleimani and other commanders, like the general who was assassinated a couple of days ago, all of them were the defense. They constituted the defense lines of the country. They constituted Iran's defenses against chaos in this region. The Americans and their regional allies have destroyed so much of Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Yemen, Lebanon, Palestine or Gaza, and to the north of Iran, we see instability. So these generals and these senior officials are what have preserved stability in this country, despite the fact that the United States has shown such great animosity and hostility towards the country. So there is no option but to give a harsh response to the act of war. What will that response be? I'm sure it will be lethal, but I have no idea what sort of response the Iranian military or mm-hmm. the Iranian intelligence services will give. I'm not privy to that sort of information. But what I do know is that there will be another response, and that is decreased cooperation with regards to the nuclear program in Iran and an expansion of Iran's nuclear program.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this will be the second punishment, where the Americans and the Europeans will learn that by hurting Iran, they act in their actions are effectively detrimental to their own interests.
Well, Dr. Mirindi, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Iranian experts to preserve the scientific and technical legacy of the nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and ordered the punishment of his assassins. We all remember the retaliation of for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, which shook the American presence in Iraq. What are the prospects of something similar, maybe as a retaliation for Israel, as well as maybe the military presence of the U.S. in the region?
Well, the response to the murder of General Soleimani by the Americans was not the final response. It was a response.
Mm-hmm.
The leader said that that was only one step. So we still have score to settle. With regards to General Fakhrizadeh, I think the response will be the same. It will be comprised of different components. One component will be lethal, and another component will be a loss of access to Iran's nuclear program and an increased speed
mm-hmm.
in the development of that program.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mohammad Mirindi, professor at Tehran University, for talking to us about the prospects of retaliation of what Iran will be possibly be doing against the assassins of Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We'll talk in the next segment about how the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad is trying to impose its views on the Iraqi government and nation.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. Embassy in Baghdad again tries to impose its views on the Iraqi government and prevents the results of the investigation into the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Popular Mobilization Unit's Deputy Director Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis from reaching the Iraqi parliament. If this is not imposing colonial decisions on a sovereign Iraqi nation, I really don't know what is. U.S. blocks Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani's probe results in this following report.
It should not really come as a surprise that the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad is blocking the arrival to the Iraqi parliament of the results of investigations into the January terrorist attack on Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the second in command of Iraq's popular mobilization units. The investigation into the attack began from the first moment of the assassination, and the Iraqi judiciary dealt with that incident as a criminal act that took place on Iraqi land on the grounds that some of the victims are Iraqis. Earlier in July, a conclusion by the United Nations described the U.S. assassination of the Iranian commander as unlawful. No surprise there either, as the U.N. cannot say more than that, or else it won't be a U.S. puppet anymore, and that is technically not possible. Meanwhile, the way the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad is imposing its views on the Iraqi government and preventing the results of the investigation into the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis from reaching parliament simply shows that the U.S. still considers itself as the High Commissioner of Iraq. It seems the memo of the Iraqi parliament issuing a bill to force the U.S. out of the country has not reached the U.S. Embassy yet, or so they would like to think. However, this is what the different Iraqi resistance factions of the Popular Mobilization Units have been warning from. The Popular Mobilization Units has declared several times in the past few months that it will no longer tolerate the U.S. occupation, be it in the form of military occupation or political one. It seems the U.S. is not willing to take these warnings seriously unless and until a full-fledged confrontation occurs in the country, shaking it to its core. Mind you, not only Iraq will be affected by such a scenario, but all the U.S. troops illegally residing all across the region of West Asia will be feeling the heat of such a confrontation.
Now with us to discuss this issue is Joaquin Flores, who is editor at Forced Rus. Thank you very much for being with us, Joaquin. Now, it's like as if the United States is revolting against the Iraqi sovereignty here and the Iraqi people as well within their own country by disrupting the track of a probe of the investigation of the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Deputy Director of the Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. What do the Americans want to hide? I mean, they already took full responsibility of the assassination already.
Well, that is an excellent question, and thank you, Marwa. Look, there is nothing to hide here, and that's what's very interesting, and I think that your question is a fantastic one, because really what we're looking at is not only the symbolism of the United States basically showing that they are in control of this process in Iraq, but I suspect that there is something else going on, which is the fact that the response that we have seen from Iraqi lawmakers, which has been a correct one, is also very predictable and one that the Americans would have and could have, and I think did predict. And those are the questions that we have to really dig into because, you know, the United States could have very easily kept its one report over here, that its internal report, perhaps showing the role of Israel, perhaps showing and revealing some aspect of their own operations in these assassinations, including that of Abu Mahandis, which absolutely is in the interest of Iraqi governance. On the other hand, they did not produce a fake report or a redacted or edited report. They just said, we're not going to show you the report. So this, obviously gives a greater strength and greater cause to the resistance to occupation, which I suspect very much is aimed towards that goal of actually shifting things away from the diplomatic end and really actually saying to Iraq, you need to have a stronger alliance with Iran in order to reject any future U.S. occupation, which sounds strange at first glance, except that the United States, we are in a period of interregnum between two kings, if you will. So it looks like the Trump administration may be trying to track or boost along any possible options that a Biden administration may have, by which I mean under Biden, we will see, of course, the return of ISIS and al-Qaeda activities very strongly in Iraq and in Syria.
Well, Joaquin, 2 days after the assassination back in January 2020, the Iraqi lawmakers approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign troops, military forces led by the United States from their country. Now, the U.S. has yet to abide by this bill. Some U.S. officials even claimed that their troops will only change location from Baghdad to Kurdistan, the northern part of the country. What options do you think Iraq has in the event that the new U.S. administration decides to actually just relocate instead of withdrawing the troops?
I think that any potential incoming administration, if that is what happens, we are still, of course, about 20 days away or 15 days away from knowing who the next president will be. But that said, if in the event of a Biden administration, we will see the return of ISIS al-Qaeda activities very strongly. And while Iran may be looking towards a rapprochement with Iran regarding the JCPOA, that is a two-pronged and very duplicitous
plan of Atlanticism to entrap and ensnare Iran in a different route. So when we look at what Iraq's response will be, it is again predictable. They want Iraq to say, this just proves that we need to double down on PMU, we need to increase support to actually and orient ourselves towards removing the U.S. occupation, and that we are gonna make maybe declarations that there's a military possibility for this, which we have already seen. And I'm afraid that this falls right into the script that they had desired that Iraq's response to be, because like I said, they could have given a redacted report and said, this is the whole thing. They could have wrote a fictitious report. The CIA is very well known for writing fictitious reports, but they did it really a slap in the face, a diplomatic maneuver on purpose to elicit this response. So I would just caution everyone not to respond in the predictable ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Iraqi PMU here, Joaquin, has warned several times over the past few weeks that it is ready to engage in a full confrontation with the occupation forces of the United States in Iraq if they defy the Iraqi official decision to withdraw foreign U.S. troops, making them leave for good from the country. Do you think maybe Biden, if he gets to office, will be in a position to risk the safety of his troops in Iraq by maybe extending their stay rather than having another plan for that?
Absolutely. And I think that this is what is being set up. I think that when we're looking at the sabotage of any potential coming back of a JCPOA, would definitely the EU's requirement would be some sort of Iranian disengagement with Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what was already the pressure that was happening before.
Mind you, the assassination of the scientists of the Iranian nuclear physicist will just make things worse.
That is exactly right. And so we can see that these are intended to elicit responses. Now, I would expect, of course, politicians and Iraqi parliamentarians have to appeal to their base. The people of Iraq are sick and tired of this occupation. It's been going on forever. There are people who were born during the occupation or are now members of the military fighting the occupation. That's how long this occupation has been going. They have every right to resist it under any rubric of international law or any moral ethical foundation that we understand in the world.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we have to avoid falling down the route of a prescripted, proscribed reaction, which is to say that, you know, we are going to go double down on any military response and so forth. It's questionable that the United States already knows that would be the response, is therefore trying to railroad any possible ability for any Biden administration to engage differently. It will force a Biden administration to engage militarily in Iraq, which of course would mean that it would be very difficult for Iranian lawmakers who themselves are very responsible to their own electorate in Iran's democracy. So this would make it very difficult for Iran to engage in the JCPOA return under such conditions.
Well, I want to discuss with you a bit the role of the UN here, which is a bit satirical, to be honest with you. Earlier in July, a conclusion by the UN described the U.S. assassination of the Iranian commander as unlawful, quote unquote. Now, Agnes Callamard, who is the UN special rapporteur on extrajudicial summary and arbitrary executions, she concluded in a report that the assassination was in breach of international law. Okay, what has the UN done so far to bring those responsible to justice?
Right. You know, that is a very good question. I think that, in fact, because of the way that the UN was set up in the aftermath of World War II and its relationship to the Bretton Woods Agreement and the IMF, in fact, I would say that the United Nations is perfectly all right to simply make these very obvious and toothless declarations if the alternative is that the UN's actual actions would be directed by those who in fact control the UN through the various and multitudinous different NGOs and organizations that operate within the UN's legal, humanitarian, and cultural departments and subdivisions. It's really, really controlled not by friends of Iraq and not by friends of Iran. And yet it actually lends an undue amount of credibility that there is an international community which has decided that despite, you know, this being obviously a breach of international law, that no action should be taken. I would prefer that the UN get out of the business of trying to take actions under the rubric of international law, and that we really look at the older and more historically coherent concept of regions of control.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that in terms of Iran as a local hegemon, that it's really about what local players are willing to work with Iran and understand that Iran is probably the most powerful regional hegemon, and that we don't need to introduce international law to include players who don't really have a skin in game to interfere with Iran's sovereignty and its ability to broker peace in the region.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Joaquin Flores, editor at Fort Truth, for being with us to discuss how the U.S. is blocking the probe from reaching the Iraqi parliament, the probe about the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and popular mobilization second in command, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Thank you very much for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. A former head of U.S. election security who said Donald Trump's defeat by Joe Biden was not subject to voter fraud should be taken out at dawn and shot, a Trump campaign lawyer has said. Condemnation of Trump campaign lawyer Joe DiGenova's remarks about Chris Krebs was swift, including calls for his disbarment and the charge he was behaving like a mob attorney. Chris Krebs was fired as head of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISO, on 17th of November, not long after he said the election contrary to Donald Trump's claims, was the most secure in American history. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, "Trump Lawyer, Ex-Election Security Chief Krebs Should Be Taken Out and Shot." Stay with us for more of Martin Pengelly's article. Former head of U.S. election security who said Donald Trump's defeat by Joe Biden was not subject to voter fraud should be taken out at dawn and shot, a Trump campaign lawyer, Joe DiGenova, has said. Condemnation of Joe DiGenova's remarks about Chris Krebs was swift, including calls for his debarment and the charge that he was behaving like a mob attorney. Chris Krebs was fired as head of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISO, on 17th of November, not long after he said the election, contrary to what Donald Trump has claimed, was the most secure in American history. Chris Krebs also used Twitter to publicly debunk Donald Trump's conspiracy theories. DiGenova defended the president in the Russia investigation and is now involved in attempts to overturn results in battleground states. The Trump campaign has won one lawsuit and lost 39 others. DiGenova made the remark about Chris Krebs on The Howie Carr Show, a podcast shown on YouTube and Trump-allied Newsmax TV, on Monday, 30th of November. Anybody who thinks the election went well, he said, like that idiot Krebs, who used to be the head of cybersecurity, that guy is a Class A moron. He should be drawn and quartered, taken out at dawn and shot. Howie Carr did not challenge the remark on his television show. A day earlier, Chris Krebs told CBS's 60 Minutes program, "Trump was trying to undermine democracy, to undermine confidence in the election, to confuse people, to scare people." Donald Trump called the interview ridiculous, one-sided, and an international joke. DiGenova is not the first close Trump aide to call for the death of an official in the president's disfavor. In early November, former campaign chief and White House strategist Steve Bannon said FBI Director Christopher Wray and public health expert Anthony Fauci should be beheaded. He was banned from Twitter for that remark. Joe DiGenova said Donald Trump's legal team was talking to the jury, trying to influence the jury, and that includes judges and state legislatures, and the governors in these states are a bunch of losers, along with their secretaries of state. I've never seen such wimps wearing a Republican badge. You know, they're going to have to be dealt with politically. It's the only way you deal with these people. Brad Raffensperger, the Republican Secretary of State in Georgia, who has resisted attempts to overturn Joe Biden's win there, has said he and his wife have received death threats from Donald Trump's supporters. Condemnation of Joe DiGenova's remarks about Chris Krebs was swift. Lois Clark, chief executive of the Government Accountability Project, said in a statement, "Threats like these trigger an avalanche of them. They terrorize other whistleblowers into silence. Its behavior befitting a mob attorney." Frank Figliuzzi, a former FBI deputy director, said Joe DiGenova had made a retaliatory threat against Chris Krebs' official duties in violation of federal law Title 18 U.S.C. 351. Andrew Weissman, a former federal prosecutor and senior aide to Special Counsel Robert Mueller in the Russia investigation, tweeted that the remark was shocking and that Joe DiGenova should face disbarment at least. Chris Krebs, he said, had shown fearless integrity.
the debate.
In this edition of the debate, we will look at the abysmal human rights record in Saudi Arabia and how member countries of the so-called international community continue their dealings with Saudi Arabia, one of their initiatives being economic gains.
7 out of the 9 European countries which have appointed human rights ambassadors have criticized the continued detention of women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia. In a statement, the ambassadors of the UK, the Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Estonia, Luxembourg and Finland call for the release of all political detainees in Saudi Arabia.
We remain deeply concerned by the continued detention of at least 5 women rights activists in Saudi Arabia. Peaceful activism and advocating for women's rights is not a crime. We join the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, special rapporteurs and treaty bodies in reiterating our call for the release of all political detainees, including women's rights activists.
The envoy especially drew attention to the cases of 2 activists, Lujain Al-Hathloul and Samar Badawi. Hathloul was put on trial last Wednesday after 900 days in prison, but her case was transferred to the Specialized Criminal Court. That's the institution that Amnesty International says is used to, quote, silence dissent. She is charged with attempting to destabilize the kingdom for defying Riyadh's ban on women's driving 1 month before it was officially lifted in June 2018. The case of Badawi, who had also campaigned against a driving ban, was earlier sent to the same court. Along with the European Human Rights Envoys, Chairman of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee Adam Schiff has also called for the immediate release of the activists. But both the Europeans and the U.S. have so far only paid lip service to the Saudi suppression of dissent and other gross human rights violations. Saudis have a long list of violations of human rights. They have led a deadly crackdown on a decade-long uprising in the oil-rich and Shia-majority eastern province, especially in Qatif region, where protesters seek an end to discrimination and political marginalization. That's beside what Human Rights Watch calls infringement on freedom of expression, association and belief, as well as migrant workers' rights. Riyadh has also helped Bahrain quash the 2011 uprising for democracy, supported an armed Takfiri terrorist in Syria, and has been leading a bloody war of aggression on Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children. But silence has been Western countries' reaction to Riyadh's role in Bahrain and Syria. And in Yemen, the West has encouraged and supported the Saudis by continuing to sell the kingdom the arms it uses to kill civilians. These are besides sweeping the Jamal Khashoggi case under the rug after the US Central Intelligence and the UN clearly linked his murder to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Riyadh appears to have carte blanche on abusing human rights, which limits Western reactions to his crimes to occasionally strongly worded statements. Actions, however, remain lacking thanks to Europeans and the US's lucrative trade deals with Saudi Arabia.
Joining us for this edition of the debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar joins us from New York. We have author and academic Lawrence Davidson joining us from Westchester. I'd like to welcome you both. Lawrence Davidson, I'm going to first start with you and just pretty much ask you a very, very simple question. Saudi Arabia, human rights, what comes to your mind immediately?
Well, what comes to my mind is a dictatorship that uses religion as a cover, and an economic resources it has to essentially buy the silence of everybody else. There's other things that are going on here, and it's not only the economic deals that you've mentioned in the introduction. There's a reluctance on the part of the international community, which is a nation-based community, to seriously interfere in what they consider to be the internal affairs of other countries. And this is an age-old principle. It started to break down after the Second World War, and the example we got with the Holocaust and the Stalinist concentration camps that he ran in the West, and so that started to deteriorate. But now it's back. So the reluctance to have anyone interfere in another country's what is considered their internal affairs is something that holds back these countries from going beyond strong statements. And it's also what underlies vetoes, often vetoes in the Security Council and that sort of thing. So it's got a history to it.
Okay, the reason why we have this topic for this debate, Daniel Azar, is the case of five women, which has been highlighted, especially with these five European countries, for example, who are deeply concerned about their detention, because right now they've been referred to the Special Criminal Court for terrorism and national security. One of them is this lady by the name of Hathloui, who was targeted because of a law barring women from driving, which later, obviously, that law was annulled. So tell us what you think that somebody was detained for that is now in a court, a special criminal court for terrorism and national security.
Well, I mean, Saudi Arabia is quite simply the most undemocratic country on the face of the earth, and that includes us, North Korea, other terrifying dictatorships. But Saudi Arabia is in a class by itself. First of all, the country is wholly owned by the Al Saud, the House of Saud. It's really their private property. They treat it as their private property. They monopolize political power, and they simply do not grant the slightest rights to other people who live there. In the case of this woman who was arrested, it's a classic example of what happened in Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, knew he had to loosen the regulations on women, banning women from driving for purely international reasons. He did so, but at the same time, he clamped down on women agitating for that right from within, because he can't tolerate any kind of challenge to his authority, no matter how mild, no matter how circumspect, even if he agrees with what the challengers are calling for. So it's a total dictatorship, a total crackdown, and one which allows for absolutely no free expression by individuals outside the royal family. And even within the royal family, I might add, there's a reign of terror that prevents any kind of criticism of Mohammed bin Salman or his father, King Salman.
Well, Lawrence Davidson, you mentioned the economic gains here. I'm looking at the fact that you have these five European countries that have come out and made these statements. But what is the checklist when it comes to dealing with Saudi Arabia? I mean, when these countries like the U.S., like the U.K. or France, take a look at this checklist when it comes to the issue of human rights, well, they're going to go down and see, well, you know, people are being put in jail, there are sham trials. Oh, and there's a war that they're killing people in Yemen, for example, and yet they're dealing with them. They're dealing with the Saudi regime, going to the G20, giving them, again, another stamp of approval, of acceptance in the business community, per se. So that kind of sounds like double standards when it comes to the so-called international community.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're looking for morality in international affairs, it's not there in any driving or practical way. After the Second World War, lip service was paid. It was thought required to be paid to human rights because of the horrors of the Holocaust and other genocides that were coming down the line and all this sort of thing. So you had the international community, particularly Western countries, taking a verbal stand against that. But when it comes to diplomatic relations, when it comes to economic profit, all of these countries, one way or another, are you know, they have internal important companies that are making money off of Saudi Arabia, and so they feel that they have to maintain that double standard. And again, it's the history of international relations that in fact you do not bring morality into it in any serious way. Here in the United States, there's been a long-standing debate between idealists and realists. Realists are those who, you know, want to dispense with morality when it comes to international relations, and they generally have won the argument. And so it's not a surprise. And I don't think it's going to change under Biden, certainly. And this is the way it is until we can resurrect some sort of, you know, standards of morality for international relationships. International law seems presently dead in the water.
Well, there was almost a total embrace when it came to Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince Daniel Azar, when he introduced his reform agenda. I mean, you have headlines like the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, power behind the throne. And then there was a shakedown that happens where you had all these wealthy businessmen, some of them princes, at the Ritz-Carlton, alongside people being jailed. And then you had the assassination of Khashoggi, which was in the worst way with the dismemberment, etc. So what happened to the reform agenda? I mean, when we talk about the way that Saudi Arabia is still being embraced, whilst it has committed these atrocious crimes that are in the human rights arena, it's basically giving it a stamp of approval to continue dealing with it.
Yes, yeah, so you've got to bear in mind that not only is Saudi Arabia the most undemocratic country in the face of the earth, it's also the sick man of the Middle East. Its political institutions are in disarray. Its economy is a wreck thanks to the fall in oil prices. MBS's attempts to diversify the economy have gone nowhere. And the reign of terror that MBS is conducting will eventually backfire, and will eventually lead to his own doing. He's a dictator isolated in his palace. He's surrounded by enemies on all sides. It's only a matter of time before he falls. And if he falls, there will be chaos. So that's what the Western countries, the so-called Western democracies, are trying to prevent. They're trying to uphold the Saudi regime by all means possible. And so if Mohammed bin Salman makes some kind of gesture towards reform, the U.S., Britain, France, et cetera, all cheer wildly, all in the hope that there's somehow this story will have a happy ending. But it won't. The regime can only crash and burn. It's profoundly unstable. Its days are numbered. We don't know how long it'll last. It could be days, could be years, could conceivably be even longer. But the handwriting is on the wall. This is a regime slated for self-destruction.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Lawrence Davidson, about an issue that many are not aware of, and that is the suppression that happens in the eastern Qatif region where the Shia minority actually live. And we need to talk about that because these people are being suppressed. And also, at the same time, we can compare the suppression to what's happening to the Shias in Bahrain. So here you have these two brothers, namely Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, suppressing the Shia population in their countries. What's your take on that?
Well, these particular dictators, both in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, have been raised within this Sunni. The Sunni Muslim sect to see Shiites as dangerous, as heretics, and this sort of thing. And now, and in Saudi Arabia, you've got this sort of weird kind of situation where it's Shiites who work in the oil fields in the east. And so they're constantly under observation and suspect. So essentially, because the Sunni rulers expect or see the Shiites as dangerous and heretical, they expect an uprising, and so they suppress them and create the conditions for an uprising. It doesn't, you know, it's not an indication that these guys are thinking things through. But it's an ideologically driven kind of hatred that they have. And so it's not surprising that the suppression of the Shiites in Saudi Arabia is longstanding. It's not new. And periodically, you know, the Shiites react in stronger ways or less stronger ways, but it's ongoing. And it's certainly not surprising that the Saudis intervened to support the Sunni minority regime in Bahrain. So in both cases, they saw it in their international, they see this in their, in terms of their internal interests to maintain their own dictatorship.
Daniel Azar, another thing that Saudi Arabia has been really critiqued for is this Sharia law, but not that the Sharia, the way that Sharia is practiced. Not that Sharia in Muslim countries that practice it is something that's bad, but because a distorted version of it has been adopted by one of the worst entities that actually spelled danger for much of the world, and that was for the Daesh terrorists, who adopted this type of ideology in their own warped way. And many said that perhaps that emanated from Saudi Arabia. Do you see that being, that Saudi Arabia is guilty somewhat of that?
Oh, of course. I mean, listen, since 1979, the takeover of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, the Saudi royal family has been determined to burnish its credentials, its Islamic credentials, by exporting its own brand of Islam, which is a brand known as Wahhabism, which is extremely harsh, extremely intolerant, and which enforces a very unforgiving form of Sharia. So what we've seen throughout the Sunni world since 1979 has been the Wahhabization of the Sunni world. This is evident from Indonesia to the suburbs of Paris. And this has had a dramatic effect, and it's wreaked havoc both within the global Muslim community and also in terms of that community's relations with the outside world. It's promoted a very xenophobic, inward-looking, anti-modernist point of view, which has been disastrous for Muslims first and foremost. And of course, it's also driven the conflict with Iran. Bear in mind, anti-Shiaism is in, goes to the heart of the Saudi regime. In 1803, I believe it was, the al-Saud launched an attack on, I believe it was Karbala, in which thousands of Shiites were killed. And so this strain of belief goes way back as far as the regime is concerned. And so the al-Saud, the royal family, has placed itself at the disposal of the United States, which has used them as kind of their Praetorian guard to police the Middle East and impose a kind of a Wahhabist conformity throughout the Middle East in order to marshal opposition to Iran and its allies.
And finally, my question to you, Lawrence Davidson, you said that the incoming administration, if confirmed, once confirmed in the U.S., is going to carry on as business as usual. Why do you say that? You don't think there will be a change in the way that it approaches Saudi Arabia, especially when it comes to things like the war in Yemen?
Yeah, well, what my position on this is that economic relations with Saudi Arabia will continue as usual. It's much too lucrative for the economy, U.S. economy, which isn't in very good shape, to not do that. So Biden will continue his relationship with Saudi Arabia, particularly in terms of economics. Now, with a proper amount of pushing on the part of the more progressive elements, and maybe some of the people that he's actually bringing into the State Department and the NSA and what have you, we might be able to push him to withdraw U.S. support, active support, for the war in Yemen. There were, and there might be still, U.S. naval ships in the area that help it in the blockade and what have you. It's likely that we can encourage Biden to remove that kind of support for the Saudi war in Yemen. But there will be no breakage of economic or diplomatic relations and this sort of thing, unless the Saudi prince oversteps his bounds. The killing of the journalist, which happened in another country, albeit in a Saudi embassy, but still, it happened in another country, in Turkey. And Khashoggi was an American, had an American green card. And so that kind of behavior comes very close to overstepping the bounds and requiring some sort of reaction. Now, he got away with that, at least with the Americans this time. If he tries that again, or if there's repeated examples of that, then he's going to get into trouble in the international environment.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, I have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar, thank you for your comments, and author and academic Lawrence Davidson there with his comments. Thanks for tuning